Welcome to the Life in the Stocks podcast, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matt Stocks. I'm the host, and the show features unedited, in-depth, candid conversations with a wide range of musicians, actors, comedians, and creatives. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to Life in the Stocks on your favorite podcast platform. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and indeed all major podcast platforms. Be sure to give me a follow on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as well, at Matt Stocks DJ. That way you can keep up to date with all of my live Q&A dates, my DJ performances, and of course, who's coming up on the show as well. But without further ado, let's crack on with the show, shall we? Here we go.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The shiny miracle of modern creation. Chop up, baker, you know how we buzzing. Anytime, anytime when we come, no sub we shock on our steam. Chop up, cause you know how we buzzing. Anytime when we come, we are shock on our steam. Get up and come and do something like this. Fly in the sky forever working. Yeah, I know, so we are shock on.
So, Steve, I reckon we should start by talking about the facility, the space that we're in, and the history of, I guess, what Music Community and Asian Dub Foundation share. Because I guess it was a key part of the early history of this band,
very
right?
Could
I just bring you right into this mic? Is that okay?
Yeah.
So we can get you sounding nice.
Well, an interesting history. It's called Community Music. This is Community Music. It's changed a lot. But I mean, initially, when they set it up in the early 80s, I wasn't there then, but it was actually set up by a lot of lefty jazz musicians. My guy called John Stevens, who was actually played for John and Yoko.
Really?
Well, yeah.
Wow.
As well as a whole load of, I think, the most famous one. Well, they probably played with every kind of famous sort of avant-garde-y, sort of jazzy sort of person in London, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of well known as... very much that sort of pre-punk 70s lefty music thing.
Which John Zorn kind of stuff?
Earlier.
Earlier
I would have
than
thought,
that.
Actually, I would have said someone like John Zorn would have come from that. He was
right.
More of a... He was more kind of post-punk version of it, I think.
Right, yeah. On.
But what was interesting is I did actually see him in the 80s when I was very young, not knowing what my future was going to be. It was free jazz, you know. What they call squeaky bonk, just pure full-on noise.
That's the term for it, is it? Squeaky bonk.
Well, that's what they used to call it, I know.
That's now that is a genre
like.
Name.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I can't say I listen to that anymore. It's not that interesting, I think, musical form, that. But when I first heard it...
Exciting.
It's pure noise, yeah. Basically. I mean, and it was big influence on rock in many ways, actually. Even American hardcore, Bad Brains... incorporated that kind of avant-garde free jazz into their music, you know. And earlier, I'd say even groups like The Who, you know,
definitely.
Jimi Hendrix.
Cream, all that stuff.
Cream, all
yeah,
that
yeah.
stuff was taken that sort of free form, especially noise and what have you. So Community Music was founded with that, right? And what he did was really cool because he was a great egalitarian. And he came up with his whole series of methods called Search and Reflect. Well, it doesn't matter who you are, what you are, what your background is, whoever you've got in the room, you can get them to make music together. Doesn't matter if they're tone deaf, doesn't matter if they're whatever, whoever.
You know? So it's stripping away often the class of it all.
Absolutely. It was a very, very radical kind of thing. Very early 70s, but one of those things that actually carried through. Now, Dr. Das, you know, did a music teacher training course here, and as I did later as well. And we incorporated a lot of the ideas in the way we built ADF, you know. It was like, an ADF was a community workshop, basically. It was like, you know, there was a lot in the early 90s, there was a lot of BMP stuff, and there was a lot of, you know, we were a bit older, but there was a lot of that whole Asian thing, for want of a better word, you know, was coming of age in the early 90s. No one had even taken notice of that sort of demographic culturally, really.
Yeah, no.
You just had a load of prejudices or stereotypes about India, you know. Either it was sitting cross-legged, George Harrison going a Maharishi yogi, or it was the nasty, more racist thing, what are they doing over here, they smell and whatever, all that. And the butt of jokes on 70s sitcom. Growing up in that era, I can't think of what was said about, you know, about people from the Indian subcontinent.
Yeah, the Indian experience.
The 70s and early 80s, there's nothing really. It really was a series of really awful kind of stereotypes, you know. So by the time we got to, you know, the early 90s, it was just all of a sudden there was a load of us, all from different backgrounds, different ages. We all had a real reason to get out there and make a lot of noise.
I guess a common experience as well.
Yeah, common experience, but very, I'm was massive, nothing in common at all with, say, Dido, our original singer. I was already 10 years older than him, you know. I'm mixed, my mother's English, I was from South India is my roots. He's Bangladesh, he was like 15, Muslim, you know what I mean? But we all kind of like wedded together. And the older members, we were rooted in sort of, you know, dub reggae, post-punk, you know, kind of Public Image vibe. We all loved Jar Wobble.
They're still writing and releasing incredible music as well. Yeah, people can say what they want about John as a individual, and, you know, obviously some of his views sometimes are a little bit controversial for some people. Yeah. Mm. But ultimately, I think what will live on with that guy is his musical output. And Pill, especially, is still now still radical and exciting and out there.
Jar Wobble as well has much to do with that as well.
Of course.
But it is, I mean, whatever you say about Lydon, you know, it's very rare you've got someone who changed music twice.
Yep.
I mean, Sex Pistols and Public Image. You know, it still sounds, you can use the Public Image vibe, it still sounds good. We still do it, you know, in ADF. We still got that. You know, it's still a kind of default sort of foundation for us.
Does the cocktail of sounds definitely come from that mixture of backgrounds and ages and influences?
Absolutely, because we think about it, you know, dub reggae, hip-hop, you know, things like Gil Scott-Heron and stuff like that, you know, acid house. I first met Dr. Das during the acid house era. I wasn't even playing guitar. I was like just doing zibidi, it was a busy, you know. So we had that. Live electronics, very big thing. I was lucky and I got, our first gig was with the Orbital. And when Orbital started, it was really, people don't realise quite how radical they were, because they were actually running, they were bringing all these bits of gear and running it live. No DATs or deep nor decks, all live. Weird and Wonderful Machines. And they were always like nervous as hell. And the first time I saw them was at the first gig we played together, early 1990. And I thought, God, this is great. And then about an hour into it, I was going, why am I getting so excited by these two bald guys looking at each other, looking really tense? And then I realised, they're playing live. That setup is so primitive and mad, it can fall apart any moment, and they know it. And that's what's good. It was almost like the complete opposite of DJ culture and stuff.
So that was actually
a big root of ADF. That was before community music, actually. We used to go to these raves. I played guitar as well. He got me to play guitar at raves over drum beats and sampled Indian stuff. That's where it first started.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Dr. Das was a nuttery to get a bagpipe player, get an Indian singer in. And
so basically nothing was off limits.
Nothing was off limits. But it was always with Dr. Das, it was always militant. There was none of the acid or everyone hold hands. It was always oppositional. And I really felt that strongly. And we had, when we first met, I'll tell you, the advert, there used to be a listings magazine called City Limits. And he put an advert in and it said, Black stroke Asian musicians required for experimental dub noise project. And I was the only one that answered. And we instantly had Adrian Sherwood and On You Sound in common, you know what I mean? And I was a huge Sonic Youth fan as well. It was like my dream was to combine Sonic Youth with kind of electronic dub music, you know.
Which hadn't been done really, had it, at that
not
point?
Not really. I
especially
mean,
not in the UK.
No, not really, no. No, not at all. I mean, they kind of did it themselves with that Ciccone Youth album a bit, you know. But, so that was our first point of meeting. And then he called me up to join. He'd started ADF for about 3 months. He called me up to join. And then I took a course at Community Music. And so the ADF was very much part of that place. Formed in that place, observed the philosophy of that place, but also was very, very on the cutting edge of that moment, both in terms of music and the sort of cultural environment. You know.
What springs to mind is the overriding mood of mid-90s when the band's getting ready to put out its first album in terms of politics, culture, music. We've sort of touched on, obviously, I guess Britpop was the predominant thing, but then all
the
great underground music was, you know, you're talking about rave and avant-garde.
Well, he had a lot of the trip-hop stuff, but he also had a burgeoning French rap scene, which was quite, which we kind of like. When we first did really well in France, totally by surprise.
And is that because the English kind of press and people weren't taking notice of the bands, so you thought,
well, the
let's
English
just go
press
over
at that
there
time, and... The thing is about now, well, people criticise now, you know, as compared to then, but there's great advantages now, is that you can actually really like something now and set up your own blog and like yourself, you know, your own podcast, and you do it because you really like it.
Yeah.
Then when you've got like three music papers or what have you like that, it's not really about, it wasn't really about liking music. You know what I mean? It was something else.
Taste making and...
It was this kind of gatekeeper thing. And what should I be writing about? You know what I mean? Not really what I
and
think.
And what should I be ignoring? What should I be criticising?
Yeah, exactly. And the people that really helped us out, who understood this, were Primal Scream, right? Because they knew, I mean, you know, Bobby Gillespie was the Pope of
rock
of
rave.
Enemy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, well, before, just as a kind of rock and roll archetype, and the fact that he dipped into Acid House and they did some really great album, actually, Vanishing Point. And they came to see us and they loved us and they wouldn't shut up about us, and it spread. So we'd done this album and it'd done really well in France, but it wasn't until we started getting sort of blessing, right, from the kind of, you know, the cool NME kind of hierarchy, that, and then all of a sudden people started taking notice of us.
And that was purely because of Bobby Gillespie name-checking you in interviews and...
Well, that's what, it's like, I think in Britain at that time, you had to find a way to get people to give you an audience. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
If you wanted to get, it's that thing. Because it's so what's the word? Heterogeneous or something now.
Yeah.
Whereas the actual
homogenized
portals,
as well. Yeah, yeah.
The portals of where people get music were much smaller. You know what I mean? Especially for live bands. I mean, it was already starting to get very pluralistic on the dance scene with, like, especially when Jungle, it was all like pirate radio, people setting up pirate radio stations in the top of their council blocks, you know, until the police moved it on, they went to another one. You know, that was very cool. We were influenced
Jungle
by that, but,
was massive in the Midlands. I remember it as a kid, like being Jungle and drum and bass were two of those predominant movements of the time.
Amazing. I thought it was really exciting. I thought it was the last breath of rock and roll, actually, Jungle. This high-speed music, mad free jazz drums, distortion bass. It even sounded a bit almost heavy rock to me, some of the...
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the drums would drop and then would come this the most distorted riff you've ever heard. But it's a reggae riff, but it's played with huge distortion. Then it comes back in at like a million miles an hour. I mean, basically, you know, we still do it in the band. But we were the first band... I think you'd be hard-pressed to find an album before our first one, which had live bass, live guitar, and I developed a style that worked with jungle breakbeats, you know, and jungle breakbeats with an MC, but also with the Indian stuff as well. I mean, but even without the Indian stuff, you know, the actual sound of the band was pretty unique because we were sort of old, sort of, you know, acid house, post-punk, sort of reggae, punky reggae people playing live bass, live guitar on top of jungleist breakbeats, you know.
Well, even now, it still sounds contemporary.
Well, it does. Like I'll tell you what does sound contemporary, if you listen to Raffi's Revenge now, is Dina's vocals.
Yeah.
Because at the time, people who came more to see us from the more rock, indie kind of background. That was a bit they had trouble with then. But now, you know, with, after 10 years of grime, it's nothing really, is it?
Yeah.
It actually sounds, the speed and the delivery, sounds like a unique take on grime now.
Yeah. Well, you're gearing up to release the 21st anniversary? And that was the album when you say that took things to the next level for the band.
Yeah, very much so.
In terms of mainstream recognition.
Very interesting that a group like us got to that, coming from the background that we come.
What do you think was the driving force and reasons as to why? Apart from the fact that you were just a shit hot band. There must have been a void there, right?
I used to have very intellectual answers to this, but I actually think it's a pretty damn good band. It sounded new, but it was very exciting, you know. It had an intellect, but it wasn't intellectual. It was very much an internationalist music, but it wasn't a kind of WOMAD music. It had a rock and roll punk spirit, but it wasn't musically based on that. It had the guitar sound, but the actual rhythm section was very much rooted in reggae and expressed through high speed jungle drum and bass things. So it was an unusual combination. Plus the fact that we were all of Asian descent, you know what I mean, and that was culture busting in so many ways. I mean, it's hard to describe now, but you know, an early gig we did, we literally had people coming up to me and saying, "Where are your tablas?" I wasn't expecting my holiday in Goa, you know, and our subject. I mean, because you see. See, back then, you know, Asians weren't meant to be where we were. We were, still to this day, we can't stand Gandhi, you know what I mean? My father hated Gandhi, but not on his way, you know, this whole, the Gandhification of Indian history, we were spit bloody, you know what I mean? That's why we wrote the song Naxalite, which is actually about a militant Maoist armed guerrilla group that still exists. I mean, they're not the nicest of people, you know. But the reason we did it was to try and say, hang on, it's not all pacifism, you know what I mean? We used to call it militant technology, and we talk about violence, the violence in Indian culture, things like that, you know.
Well, you're coming from that public enemy approach, but yeah, for your culture.
Yeah, if you like, had that. Though we were never separatists, like, unfortunately they had a bit of I loved them. Brilliant, Chuck D's still my hero. I look back and I'm not sure about the Farrakhan things and stuff. I mean, we were never about that. We were just talking about our backgrounds, really. And the reason it's called Asian Dub Foundation, because the name was needed for a particular event. And it was all, at that stage, it was all about getting young Asians involved in music. You know, that's all it was about. We had a band meeting after I joined, and Dr. Das said, all right, we're probably only going to last another 6 months. Those guys, John Pundit and Oni, they had no intention of it ever being more than a group that was, you know, doing the occasional benefit in East London. That is absolutely the genuine truth. There was no ambition to get where it got. Maybe I had a little bit of it. And Bobby, our manager, certainly did, obviously. But only because, and this is the real reason, is I thought when I started playing, this is the first time in my life. I've been in loads of bands. Been in loads of bands in Birmingham, you know. I thought, this is the first time. The world has got to hear what we're doing. They've got to hear it. There's no sort of like aspiration to be big or any of those kind of terms. It was like, the world has to hear this shit. You know what I mean? That's how I felt. And I met Bobby Marshall, and he saw it, and he felt the same way. So actually, in the early years, it was actually quite a lot of persuasion to persuade the other guys in the band
to keep
to
going,
actually go to America and support Beastie Boys.
How was that? Because that was them at their
peak. They didn't
want to
do it.
They didn't want to do it. That's unbelievable.
They didn't want to. It was just me and Bobby versus the rest. And why? I don't want to go. Who are these? And Dina never heard them. You know, why should he have done? You know,
was it a good tour for you?
Oh, amazing! What an experience. Everyone really enjoyed it. They were really great to us. You know,
what is it that actual, was it like intergalactic era for them or just
it was,
before
it was
that?
Hello Nasty, yeah.
Hello Nasty,
so
yeah.
Brilliant show, my God. I mean, I'd been a fan actually. None of the rest of the band knew them at all, really. But we were actually knocked out the whole experience. We got it as nice as you could get a support band doing a stadium tour of America. They paid for the, they paid us, right? That doesn't happen normally. Normally you've got the buy on.
Yeah, yeah.
Never had to do that.
Or you get like 50 quid a show or some shit.
Yeah, well, yeah. No, you normally have to pay to do the show.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that never happened. You know, we've never done a buy on in our lives, you know. They took our gear in their bus. They let us walk in and out of their dressing room, no problem with food and stuff like that. Some other tours we did with bigger groups, there always seemed to be this argument about whether we were allowed to have dessert or something. You know? I mean,
I know it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, these sort of basic things, and we were like really spoiled.
It's all a power play, isn't it? Some people like to pull rank to try and like reinforce their status.
Beast is nuts. And the tour manager was one of the sweetest men I ever met. You know, it was an amazing experience. And the reason we got that, they saw us by accident in Vienna. They just came to the show. Oh, they're good. I'm on the tour.
What was your live show like around that time? It must have been the most high energy.
Yeah, it was
culture
wild.
Clash cocktail.
Yeah, it was wild.
Sounds and images and ideas.
I wasn't really. It was such a blur. And
that anyone
madness,
could imagine.
You know what I mean? And ADF was then, it was an intense group. We had incredible laughs and stuff, but at the same time, we were very, you know, I think we could be a bit frightening if people came in our dressing room. They'd either think we were completely mad and this is some lunatic house, or we'd be having some argument or debate or something, you know what I mean? We'd shout a lot, like most bloody Asian households shout a lot, you know what I mean? That's a normal volume.
Are you all quite different political thinkers as well? Have you all got quite different ideas?
No one ever asked that. You're the first person in 26 years actually ever asked that. You see, the thing is like, I mean, you know, the score, I mean, a lot of journalists will try to control the narrative, things like that. So we got this political tag thing, and say to the enemy of the time, that meant Sandinista, whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That meant Che Guevara, what, you know, it's kind of like reduced sort of cliches and stuff like that, you know, a kind of rock and roll version of politics. And they tried to sort of shoehorn it into that a bit.
Yeah.
But having said that...
And Rage Against the Machine, I'm sure you would have been compared to 1,000 times,
yes,
even though the
right,
sound
yeah.
is nothing like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we never heard Rage Against the Machine. But it is weird. There were some territory where the bands did, you know, and people thought we were ripping them off, and I thought, we'd never heard it. Honestly, I thought they were just a Led Zeppelin club. Now, after when we did the tour with them, which I have to say we didn't enjoy that much, but I saw what Tom was doing, and I thought, wow, fucking hell! Actually, in a way, there was a similarity, an accidental similarity, in that on the guitar front, because he had,
creating new sounds,
yeah, creating sounds that actually where you make sure that you know you want it to stay hip hop. So you make the guitar an accessory to the hip-hop beats rather than the indie dance thing, which you had in the late 80s, which is like, you still want it basically to be an indie band, but you just put the only beat that works, you know. That was the sound of indie dance, you know. But and also when, you know, so what Tom did was he actually kind of like started really bending that guitar so it worked with actual genuine hip-hop. I did the same with Jungle and Drum and Bass. And so when I actually saw him, I thought, oh, my God, yeah. He's kind of come to the same... He's used some of the same methods as me on guitar, i.e. fuck guitarism, you know. But
yeah,
I was probably
yeah.
more than him because I threw out a lot of... I mean, you could still tell he was a rock with a capital R guitarist, whereas that's less the case with me. I'm not really... I've never really been a heavy rock guitarist. I like a lot of... you know, psychedelic playing and funk and reggae playing, do you know what I mean? And I like, what was it, who doesn't like Hendrix, you know, but was never grounded in Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin like he was, you know. But we did use the same kind of methods to make the guitar work with breakbeats and stuff. Because most people didn't, most guitarists usually got that wrong, still do actually, I think, you know. But there was that. And we did find it irritating. I mean, it was funny that because really half the band didn't know a lot of these groups that we're getting compared to. They never heard them. It's quite funny, really.
But they were, the press was putting you all on the same page politically, were they?
It was very hard for them to write about ADF. They liked it genuinely, or some of them thought they had to like it, what have you. Not many journalists actually got it. Funnily enough, it was the old school vintage journalists. Every time I saw someone like Charles Shaw Murray write about, I was like, yeah, he's got it. Do you know what I mean? Because you see, the politics thing was always misunderstood. Ours was about politics of sound. The last thing we'd ever, still to this day, I get tapes or whatever. He's like, you will like us because we are a political group. You
know? Yeah.
It just sounds fucking awful. You know, and people misunderstand that. You see, our instrumentals we considered rebellious.
Radical and...
It's the politics of sound, if anything. You know, like the idea that, you know, someone like... any music can be radical.
Oh, of course. Right. Without lyrics, you can have...
Even if the people
instrumental music.
Jazz was the ultimate, like, you know, that was the scream of civil rights, you know. You know, you got a Max Roach album, which is a free jazz album called, which is meant to accompany civil rights marches. It's free jazz. It's mad, squeaky bomb. And yet you can tell what it's about.
Yeah.
And that's was our approach. Sticking all those that stuff together, you know, dub reggae, jungle, post-punk and, you know, punky reggae. And then also lots of different music from different cultures, but not in a worldy music-y way. In a radical way. I mean, our mates.
Did you get tagged with that label a bit as well? That whole kind of world music.
No,
but you mentioned
very
a group earlier,
yeah,
Tiana Rowen. Like,
wow, well, yeah, they're fantastic.
They are fantastic.
Yeah. But I mean, that's recent development. So I think what is called world music now is weirdly it says it's a lot more diverse than it was in the '80s. It used to really annoy me because it was like. It was almost like you'd almost feel like that audience had to like all these really middle of the road, mediocre West African bands. You know what I mean? Who actually weren't that good.
Yeah.
They were just considered good.
Take the right box.
By dint of where they come from, which is a kind of, dare I say it, a kind of reverse prejudice. You
know? Of course.
One thing I said in an interview at the time, I said, I don't want to be liked just because we're a bunch of sweet brown boys. We have as much right to be shit as anybody else, right? You see what I mean? Because there's the other side of it. That, you know, one thing we would get really aggressive because we did not want to be liked for the novelty. You know what I mean? That was another thing we were really, really aware of. Now, when we were on Nation Records, we used to play with people like Transglobal and stuff like that. You know, good band, but we had a different take on it. Very different take on it, and we took off from there very quickly. We left that. We obviously weren't of that ilk, you know, this kind of funky, exotic splash of colour kind of music. You know what I mean? We were much darker, mood-wise and confrontational, you know. And we hit it off in France in about 95, totally unexpectedly, and we got a lot of people. Who were against Le Pen, you know, because Le Pen was his first big foray into national politics, and a lot of people liked the energy of what we were saying, you know what I mean, and the way we were doing it, even though they probably didn't understand a word of it, you know. And we found ourselves with a quite big selling album in France, totally expected, you know. We got a gold disc for our second one, you know, that was only released in France. That was the original version of Raffi's Revenge, just called Raffi, 97.
And that was 100,000 copies plus done.
Yeah, in 97, yeah. And it's like, what?
And so when you come to...
not aware.
When you come to score La Haine later on, I guess it was like the perfect marriage, right?
It felt...
You were like, this
is... felt very right, yeah.
Made in heaven.
Yeah. And also the film, the way it's structured... actually allowed us to kind of interject. There's about five or six scenes where there is no talking, no background sound or anything, and just the song. So we replace the song. You know, the Marley track that opens it, which is a great song. The lyric fits what's going on, burning and looting. But the rhythm doesn't. And Maciej Kasowicz himself said that to us. The director, he said, he's saying, you know, we didn't have a soundtrack. I see what you did with the opening, you know. You actually... You played a riot rhythm and sound, even though the Marley track, Burning and Looting, addresses it lyrically. It's still a Jamaican, you know, but it's not really the speed and the energy of the smashing of the glass and stuff, you know. Whereas what we do is, you know, it's a different, you know, I think he liked our interpretation of it, he saw it.
How many live shows did you do of that? Because it was over a period of years, right? You're still going with it.
Still doing it.
Was it something that once you fine tune, you're like, we can do this as long as we want, anywhere we want?
It's had a second rebirth, and we do it quite... Fundamentally, it's the same sound, same tracks. We play it with a different format, but it's fundamentally the same. It hasn't changed. Playing the same thing for 18 years, and it doesn't appear to date.
Where's some of the best shows been for that specific live score?
I actually think probably the first one at Barbican was still my favourite, really. It's very interesting because we automatically thought, well, people have to sit down and we're kind of anonymous. But it can actually be quite a vibey gig as well.
So you can have people in some cases standing, dancing.
Yeah, they're really cool. I mean, we played a festival in France where everybody knew the film inside out.
Yeah.
And it was in a big tent and they had about 5 or 6 screens of it. And we're on stage and everyone is saying the words of the film and then dancing and saying the phrases. And it's like, because I remember that they used to have the Rocky Horror Show where you'd actually go dressed up and you'd stand and shout things and throw water on people. It was a bit like that, but with lead, you know, sort of participation.
Well, this is all pre-secret cinema, isn't it?
Well, this is probably the most influential thing we ever did, because Fabien Rigaud, the founder of Secret Cinema, came to see that gig at the Barbican. And he was chasing me for a while, wanting to get together and do something, because he said that was a big influence on Secret Cinema.
Wow. Yeah. There you go.
I know. I'm extremely proud of that. My God. That's probably...
Because that's a world-famous live event now, isn't it?
I know. Yeah, yeah. Well, we did La Haine. We revived La Haine for Fabien and Secret Cinema. And we did it at Broadwater Farm.
Amazing, man.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing.
And Battle of Algiers. How does that one come on? Is that on a film that you've sort of... growing up with and been familiar with, or did it come on your radar later on?
I knew it well and I loved it. And that was a suggestion by someone else in 2003, initially, after we'd done The Hen.
Okay, straight off the back of it. Yeah,
yeah, I was off the back of The Hen, and Guy Morley at Brighton Festival, he asked to do it. And we said no, originally, because...
You didn't want to just fall into doing that, was it?
No, gladly. But yeah. We were absolutely, completely like, we're not worthy. You got scored by Morricone, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. So that was the reason.
How dare we? That was my first reaction. No way, never. I'm not going to play over Morricone. He's a genius. He's a god. You know, but then he persuaded us, and a year later we had a go, and we do work with a Morricone score. I think it's the best of the three, actually, by quite a long way, actually. As a film, the Morricone score. And how we work with it, and the fact it's got all these epic scenes. And in a way, the kind of anti-colonial sort of thing is very much at the core of ADF's sort of psycho-history, I suppose. So it's probably the best one. I hope we do it as well as we did it the first time, because we did it in 2004.
You've only done a couple of shows.
Yeah, that's right. We did it at the Dome in Brighton and Hackney Empire. It was a really, really great project. I'm very proud of it. But... We only did it twice, you know. So we'll see. It's a different. We're doing it very differently this time, you know.
What could are you? Have you got stuff planned? Have you?
Yeah, we're working on it right now. Yeah. Look, can't you see the bags? Yeah, we're trying to retrieve.
So with a view to doing what you did with La Haine and take it all over the world.
Oh, I really hope so. I hope so. Yeah, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah, cool. I hope so. But you know what? I'll be honest. You know, we've been going 25 years now. These things aren't quite as, you know, they always seem a little more unstable, you know. You know, the doing of all this. I haven't had to do so much bloody work as this for quite a long time, actually. Because it was like retrieving all the music from 15 years ago. Getting it into a form that was transportable and playable in a certain circumstance. And it's like done my nutting, actually. But no pain, no gain.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
How do you balance all of that, like the scientist in the lab going crazy? How do you balance that with your normal life and your family? And
actually, it's been a bit crap. This is the first time for a while when I've had to, you know, when I've had to really kind of like, not where, where the balance is tipped the other way. But it's not my mind and why I'm moaning, you know. I've kind of been moaning about it the last couple of weeks.
You want to get out that tunnel.
Yeah, I've got to get out that tunnel, yeah. But honestly, it was quite frustrating, actually, I have to say. But I think I've hit it now.
How many kids have you got, Steve?
I've got two. One in Birmingham, who's a musician as well. You might have heard of him, actually. Maybe Electric Swing Circus. You heard of that scene?
So what? It's like a mixture of dub and swing. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And they do a lot of nights in Moseley and stuff, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot. That's okay. Son, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There you go. Amazing.
Yeah.
So he's taken on the family business very much.
He really
so.
Has. He talks more
putting his own twist on it.
And yeah, very much so.
Go, yeah, that's quite a huge, I'm not sure like how well known it is outside the Midlands, but I know in the Midlands it's very well
And they're regarded. One of the sort of prime, you know, sort of movers of it. And they're a live band as well.
Yeah.
It's largely a DJ-based scene, I think, but they do it. He's the drummer and keyboard player with the group, and they tour all over the place. You know?
Love it.
That's amazing, really. I mean, I wouldn't know what to do now, so I'm very proud of them, because I just thought, God, how do you do that now, you know? And basically, they just spend all their time on social media, you know, and
promoting and plugging.
It's just second nature to
it. Are you engaged in that world at all? Are you an online guy?
I am, actually, but only because I have to. I'm very selective as well, you know. I say I only go on Twitter because I think I have to, you know. I don't really do Instagram, which I should, you know. Facebook, for me, that's dying, you know. I was really on it with Facebook, but it seems to be, you know, rats leaving a sinking ship on that one, you know. So I don't know, really. I don't know what you compare it with. I suppose I am, but I don't know who's a good...
Because when you were a band, obviously, coming up, it wasn't a thing, was it? At all?
It was a little bit of a thing, but not in the way that it became.
Yeah.
Not at all. I mean, it was not long into our career that Napster...
Killed the music business.
Yeah, Napster.
Did that have an impact on a band, say, of your level? Or were you more of a live band that made your... income on the road anyway.
Yes. But the peak of it was about 2003 with the fourth album, when we were playing very big shows, and that album did do very well, you know, by today's standards, very well, I'd say.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I actually read in Wikipedia the other day that it was certified gold in France. I didn't bloody know. Where's my fucking disc? Not that we're supposed to be into stuff like that, but it's
funny when you
read in Wikipedia that you got a gold disc from an album 15 years ago and you've never seen it. It's probably on some, you know, some French record company executive's like wall with his snorting car. I did all this. I love those guys. Sorry, who?
From an economic point of view, there's a lot of talk at the moment amongst young musicians and the worry about the restrictions that Brexit's going to put on them as a touring band.
Oh, Christ, yeah.
What have you got to say about that in terms of someone who really did have the freedom to tour Europe and help their career grow in that way? Is it going to have a really hardcore negative impact, do you think, on the music industry?
It depends on the resultant deal, doesn't it? I mean... But yeah, it's got to have a negative one or a disastrous one. Somewhere between, it's not going to be as easy as it was to complete disaster. I mean, you think about it, it's a 5 billion quid industry, largely based on export, you know. And if you think about it, 10 or 11 people, ADF, playing three different European countries every weekend during the summer. That's our lives now. So, customs checks, what do you call them, the documents you have to have, you know, that they don't check, you know, now. Flights, mobile calls, I mean, the visas even, you know what I mean? I mean, they can ruin tours, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, visa to go to France, you know, hopefully it won't get to that stage. No, I think it's a disaster for music. And unfortunately, when you speak, I've had debates online with some Brexiteers. And
guess, how does that
guess what their line is?
Oh, go on.
Well, the Beatles went to Hamburg.
Before the EU.
Yeah. I know. I mean, but that's what you're dealing with. You know what I mean? You know, or there was touring before. Yeah, there was touring. And a lot of tours got cancelled because people didn't get visas on time. And it was massively cool. Only supergroups could do it. The fact is that, you know, the EU, that freedom of movement and the business freedom allows medium range people to make a living out of music, like us, really. You know, I mean, I think without those benefits, it's gonna be very, very hard.
So you're saying that not even for the young upcoming bands, actually for bands of a certain
lifetime,
they're still going to be hit by it hard as well.
I think it's more a group like us that's going to be hit by anybody else, which is our main source of income. We're used to a certain just sort of like making enough to have an okay average income, do you know what I mean? With a younger band, I suppose it's, you're like 19 or whatever, you're prepared to rough it. You don't mind like staying up for like five nights a week and like crashing on the fucking floor or whatever. So might not, the travel will be more expensive and the bureaucracy, but it might not stop you from doing music. And if you're an old supergroup or whatever, like the old Moaners, like, I don't know, like the old Rockers, who actually pro-Brexit by the sound of it.
Well, there's been a video with Roger Daltrey going around, which is why I asked you about
that's
it.
That's right, yeah.
Where he's like, it's got nothing to do with music.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because someone like Roger Daltrey does so much good work for Teenage Cancer Trust, the charity, and he's a really decent bloke.
We did one of them.
But in today's world, someone like that says one wrong thing and it goes viral and everyone goes, he's a cunt, I hate him. Do you know what I mean?
He does seem a bit of I bet he wasn't, but when you see him pontificating, he does. So no, I think it's got to be negative, and it's not just about a musician. And this is the other thing: when you speak to Brexiteers online, they think if you're into music, you're in, you know, a privileged existence and what have you. But it's not just a musician, and we're not privileged at all. But riggers, drivers, you know, techs.
Or just people who want to go work in hospitality.
People, you know.
Bars and restaurants.
I mean, for fuck's sake. But then this is what's not understood, is that chain of the connectedness of things.
Yeah.
I mean, you get a festival in Britain and it travels around Europe, the same festival, with the same crew and the same stadium. How's that going to work, you know? It's not, is it?
It's a fucking minefield,
isn't
it?
It's not. You know, it's basically,
We were talking earlier on about TX1138.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go back to that real briefly. That was the that's the only one of your live score shows that I've seen at the Barbican. I think you were saying it was the first one, was the show that I caught. A very different film to the other two.
Very.
I guess less on the surface politically charged, but then
I don't know about that.
Once you scratch deeper... And that's what I wanted you to talk to me about,
it's all about surveillance, isn't
as
it?
A science fiction film. The relevance of that is almost to today's world, more so than when it was made.
I thought
it
actually had a fantastic relevance, actually, because I think it actually married quite a lot of stuff in it. There was a fundamentalist religion in it, which was very repressive. It was also tied to extreme capitalism and consumerism.
Yep.
And a massive surveillance state, you know, all in one. It was like It was like almost a compendium of dystopias up to that point, you know. I thought it was very interesting, that, and the mood of it as well. And what I really liked about it was the idea of this society had almost evolved without even people noticing. You know, when you see, I mean, there's some interesting comments on racism in it. When I spoke to Walter Murch, he was almost over the moon. I noticed that, right? Because no one knew that. There's the character in it, the hologram, the black hologram character, right? And he was told he's not a hologram, but he's told he's a hologram. He's an entertainment hologram. Do you know what I mean? And that is just like, that's how black people were seen in America at that time.
Yeah, you're there.
Yeah, they were there for singing or whatever, but they were like holograms, less not quite real, you know what I mean? I thought it was brilliant, you know? And Walter Murch, he was amazed that we picked up on that, because no one did, you know?
Well, it's not even a footnote, is it? Because Star Wars is so massive, it's so rarely even discussed or... You know, there's no attention ever really thrown on that film as like, oh, this is where the guy who went on to make Star Wars started.
Yeah, to be fair, it does have a lot of flaws. And actually, when you get into it that much, you see, visually, you know, it really made sense as a live soundtrack. But when you start getting, there are some flaws in the narrative and the actual audio, we had trouble with it, you know. Now, I would have done it a bit differently again if I'd done it, if we do it again, which now I hope we will. One you saw was like you were saying earlier, you know, it was very much dependent on the room and the people and what have you. So whereas something like La Haine is successful pretty much every time we do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So and there is, it's to do with the intrinsic qualities of the film as well. You know what I mean? La Haine is a much better film. But
of course, yeah. Well, that's like an experimental student film, really.
Yes, it's an experimental student film, and also it's niche. Actually, yeah. Appealed to me personally a lot more than a neutral person, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Well, it's not even a cult classic as a film, is it, really?
Not really, no. Though some people think it is. It's a debated one, you know what I mean? Whereas La Haine and Battle of Algiers are, and there's no debate about those. So in a way, it was a bit risky to HX. And, you know, it's some incredible shows, like Cambridge, Bristol... We did a few, really. Up San Francisco, we did a good one. But then we did a few kind of like ones that didn't work, like Sydney Opera House or whatever.
You did one there, really?
No, it's insane. It was not good, actually.
You got to dream big, though. Why was it? Why did it not work? Is it just too much of a grandiose setting? No.
I don't want to talk too much about that. Start to get, you know.
Are there many other films? Because it's become almost like a side project of your own band, if that makes sense.
It's a version of the band.
Do you know what I mean? Is there many other projects you could see yourself down the line exploring and delving into from a filmic point of view?
From a filmic point of view? I don't know. I mean, because doing Battle of Algiers again, you know...
That's going to take up a lot.
I can't see another one. There's actually one that me personally I'd like to do, actually, but I'd like to do it on a smaller scale, I think. Because these projects, they're big projects, you know. When we did THX, we got quite a lot of support for it. We had like two articulated trucks for the fucking thing, you know what I mean? It's probably the biggest thing we've done on that front, technically, ever, you know? I know we did a tour of quite very big venues in France once with, you know, a lot of equipment and very big venues, you know, but very rarely do we go that big. Yeah, so it was pretty big. And La Haine... When we were doing La Haine and Battle of Algiers, we had a lot of quite big tech support in it, but that's not so forthcoming now. So I don't think, personally, I don't think I'd do another one like that with the band, no. But you never know, you know. I mean, we've done all kinds of old projects, you know.
What about the band itself? Is there any new record on the horizon?
Yeah, there is. We've got one ready.
Right.
Yeah, we still might do some extra on it. I'm not sure when it's coming out, though. It's a funny thing with albums now, isn't it? They're just sort of like one of many things going on. My mind's not really on it at the moment, but I'll get back to it after this Battle of Algiers thing, you know what I mean? Once that's over with, start looking at, right, let's see what we've got. Because we have recorded quite a lot of stuff.
What's it like being in a collective and a group with so many other guys? It's a very unique...
Well, you see, that's the sort of thing that's been associated. When we started the first 6 or 7 years, we were a real genuine collective. There's no doubt we worked very differently from other groups. Like the third album, I remember literally it's all five of us sitting around with a blank piece of paper. And we wrote some, probably our best set of lyrics on the third album, because it was so collective. But it, I have to be honest, it's not really a collective now. It's a group of people that come together occasionally.
Is that because of age and life and responsibility? And
I suppose so, yeah. It's because of a lot of things, but you never know how these things are going to evolve. It still works. It still works very well, I think. But it's not in the same... Like, for the first 6 or 7 years, we were always together. And we were always based in community music. All of us were there most of the time. Do you know what I mean? So we had that kind of constant connection. So there was a great sense of balance. Ravage Revenge, you can hear it. A great sense of balance with the group. You know, it feels like you can't see the join. You can't hear the join. You know what I mean? And everyone, it's as one, you know. And I think that's magic and that's rare. And it normally happens in a group's first, you know, first initial birth, over six. We were lucky, I think it probably carried on with us for about 10, 11 years, you know what I mean? And then we had a, sort of some dips and then a gradual sort of like slope back up, which is what I think we're in now, you know. So I wouldn't say it's a collective now. I couldn't really, because a collective, it meant something very special to us, that term, that we were that. We're not that. We're not as we were in the first, say, three albums, for sure. There's no, it'd be dishonest to say that, you know.
But you're still all friends and you all still enjoy it.
Oh, we all still enjoy it. Friends? I don't know. some people are friendlier with others than others, you know what I mean? You know,
well, there's a lot of elements, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's a lot
yeah.
of elements going on. And they're a completely separate band, and it's a kind of a bad reference to make, but I just saw today that I think the fourth member now of Slipknot, who were originally nine, has now been kicked out of the band as well.
Oh, really?
And it's like when you get down to, you start with nine and then it's blah, 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 and then it's like, you know, there's one guy left and you think, well, is it still the same thing? But obviously you guys still have a lot of the original members, right?
Well, we have like two in the live band, and then the sound system is run by John, who was Pandit, who was in the original band. So it's kind of three working in the ADF world. So three out of five, which I suppose ain't bad by today's standards, you know.
Yeah.
We've had like, you know, Akhtar has been with us 19 years on and off, you know. Squidley has been with us for about the same amount of time. So it's just all of them, you know, it's quite a long span. But the newer members, you know, wow. I mean, Nathan Flutebox Lee, beatbox flute inventor, and a great drummer who used to play with the Prodigy, Brian Fairbairn as well. Fantastic guys, you know. Really amazing. So, I mean, we've had periods where it feels really rejuvenated. Certainly recently.
Anything else going on for you creatively outside of the band? Do you do any other projects?
No.
Or does this take up more than enough time?
It's all under the aegis of ADF. I mean, other members of the band have got their own things. But not me, really. Not me. And whenever I try and do it, it never sounds as good as ADF, so I don't...
So this is you now,
yeah,
for the long haul.
I've been the only one who hasn't done my own thing, actually. Yeah, if I did do something, it'd be, I would make it not like it, ADF at all. I think, you know, I don't know what it'd be. Yeah. It might not even be music.
There you go.
Yeah.
Nice one. Thanks for your time, mate. Nice talking to you.
Yeah, really nice.
This collaboration here with no ego trip. We know we no badness, no fuss or fighting with it. It's an educational. Why don't you keep up with this? Time to pay attention to the conscious lyrics. Me cry, what them I do? And what them I chat about? When you them after 9 o'clock, can't stay out of government, man. Insta run up on the mouth. Here, watching my say will happen without a doubt. And cannot think for himself. Cover the American to build up the tension with the idea to be done. No, when it is done, the level satisfaction. Then it will be as life for the human, human and woman.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.